Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here, early. Right now at Wayfair, get up to 70% off everything you need for the season ahead. Save on kitchen and dining, bedroom furniture and mattresses, holiday decor, and way more. Now is the time to score big, from seasonal finds to favorites you'll use all year long. Plus, with Wayfair, enjoy fast and easy shipping, with delivery in time for the holidays. Save up to 70% off early Black Friday deals. Shop now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
I welcome Professor Sean McMeekin, Bard College. Sean is an author of many historical narratives over the 20th century timeline. And heretofore, I've talked to the professor about his explication of the events of July 1914, prior to the First War, the Great War it was called. Now we turn to a byproduct of the catastrophe of the Great War, which is the 1930s and 1940s, the period where all of Europe was transformed into fear and loathing of two very powerful dictators, monsters, Adolf Hitler in Germany, but before that, Joseph Stalin, Jugoslavia in the Soviet Union. The new book is Stalin's War, A New History of World War II. It begins with an explanation of Stalin's viewpoint of the world. He inherited, through machinations and skullduggery and backstabbing, he inherited the control of the Communist Party, the apparatus in Moscow, upon Lenin's death. What he did with that was derive one theory of the world, I learned from the professor, and it was inherited from Stalin himself. From Lenin himself, but we begin with who Joseph Stalin is, what you need to know about his personality, how he first came to Lenin's attention as a man who was an up-and-comer revolutionary. Professor, congratulations. The book is massive. It's an enormous amount of detail, but there's stories within stories, and we begin with how did Vladimir Lenin, Ulyanov, first learn of Joseph Stalin, the bandit? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John, and thank you so much for having me on once again. Well, Stalin, it's true, really first came to Lenin's attention after the notorious Tiflis heist conducted essentially in broad daylight of a kind of a bank transfer, transport, what we might call an armored car. Now, I mean, I should say a couple of things about this. We shouldn't get the idea that Stalin was actually out there physically assaulting the bank guards. He was much more of a kind of behind-the-scenes operator. He was behind the plot. That is, he planned it out. He did all the essential paperwork. Not that he was physically shy, just that his real métier was for kind of conspiracy. He organized in the 1905 revolution, even before this bank heist, something called a Bolshevik battle squad, essentially to kind of conduct street warfare and almost looting operations of businesses, exploiting the chaos of the 1905 revolution in the wake of the Russo-Japanese War. So on the one hand, he was this kind of rough-and-ready bandit type. But on the other hand, he was also a theoretician. I mean, he was an intellectual. We shouldn't gainsay that. I mean, he was certainly capable of organizing these almost baroque and grotesque criminal acts such as the Tiflis heist, but he was also a kind of party organizer par excellence.
The theory that Stalin inherits from Lenin, you name as revolutionary defeatism. What is it, Sean?
Well, this is a theory that Lenin had come to both from his study of history and also effectively from his actions, at least from the First World War onwards. But going back even to recent military history, thumbnail sketch, Franco-Prussian War, 1870-71, Prussia wins, France loses, France has a revolution. You have a kind of a Paris Commune and this radical uprising in the city. Even if it failed in the end, it was still, it showed the possibility inherent in defeat. Something similar happened with the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-1905. Lenin plays a kind of a bit part in the end of it, but he's studying the political dynamic, which is once again, Russia's humiliated by Japan. So Russia suffers this kind of thoroughgoing sociopolitical revolution, chaos in the streets, violence, etc. Now, in the First World War, Lenin decided to make this explicit. He was actually reading Clausewitz at the time, and the book that he wrote about this, which derived a lot from his study of Clausewitz in military history, was called Socialism in War, basically a play on words with Clausewitz's On War. And he actually even used the term in scare quotes concerning the defeat of, quote, one's own country, by which, of course, he meant it not sarcastically exactly, but rather that a true communist, of course, was not a patriot. A true communist was an internationalist. And in fact, opportunistically, you should root for your country to lose, because that way the government's prestige would be shattered. And you could also, because the government had foolishly armed the workers, that is the proletariat, as Lenin would have seen them, even if, of course, Russia was mostly peasants more than proletarians. But the idea is that they'd put guns in their arms, and so you could kind of infiltrate the armies and turn the imperialist war into civil war. There was another layer of theory when it came to international affairs, the idea that imperialism was the highest stage of capitalism, that effectively it was kind of baked into cake. In the same way class struggle must produce the inevitable cataclysm in terms of the class war, so too would imperialism produce the cataclysm in terms of the wars between nations. And effectively this would kind of produce the cataclysm, but also the opportunity which would allow the radicals, the communists, to seize power, really, in, amidst the misery and chaos of war, in this case, world war, at least European war.
We come to 1925. Lenin's gone. Stalin is consolidating his power. He is observing that there will be war momentarily, always expecting war. He speaks, if war breaks out, we shall be the last. We shall be the last to enter. The weight that turns the scale. He's seeing the Soviet Union is hanging back from this war between the imperialist capitalist states. He's in charge, however, of building up Russia to prepare it for this great war. He does that, I learned from you, during the Coolidge administration, during the Hoover administration, and into the Roosevelt administration, by seeking the technology, the guidance, the people themselves of the great industries of the United States. Is this willingly sold and transferred to the Soviet Union? Is there any policy in Washington, Coolidge, Hoover, or Roosevelt? Let's stop with the early Roosevelt, to mitigate Stalin's men coming to America to learn.
Well, you're right that the buildup, and to some extent also the ideology behind the buildup, really gets launched in 1927 and 28. So, of course, you're talking about the kind of the late Coolidge years and then into the Hoover administration. I mean, to us, it may seem rather silly in retrospect, but in 1927, there was this huge war scare that was played up in Soviet propaganda that ostensibly had something to do with the fact that in Britain, they had finally cracked down on the British Communist Party, which they had foolishly allowed to operate legally. And in response, there's all this kind of Soviet propaganda about the imperialist designs and the Soviet Union, and they use this as a pretext to launch the first five-year plan, essentially to kind of militarize Soviet industry and, as we know, of course, mobilize all this labor from the rural areas, in addition to kind of waging war on the small peasant landowners called kulaks. But the part you're talking about with the U.S. administration and the way in which some of this is used by the Soviets, well, they'd always been dependent on foreign technology. From the earliest days after the revolution, they'd had to import arms. There'd always been some level of industrial espionage. For a while in the 20s, a lot of this was done even quite openly and legally vis-a-vis what we call Weimar Germany, going back to the Rapallo Pact of 22. The Soviets had been able to kind of copy and in some cases also just borrow designs from the Germans. But in the early 30s, and particularly after Hitler comes to power, really almost simultaneously, of course, with the advent of the Roosevelt administration in early 1933, a lot of those avenues were beginning to dry up. Some of it just because of the fact the Soviets had sort of blown through all of their inherited capital. They'd blown through the old imperial gold reserves. The Great Depression had made it much more difficult for the Soviets to tap into what might be called, strange as it sounds, the art laundering market. They were actually using a lot of the money to finance Stalin's arms buildup by selling off inherited artwork and things like the Codex Leviticus Bible. A lot of buyers just didn't have the same money anymore, and so the Soviets were always kind of a lookout both for foreign technology and also, of course, foreign funds, the ability to pay for it. And effectively, they had been they've been frozen out of the loan market in the United States because, of course, they had defaulted on all their obligations. And so there was this big campaign, and Walter Duranty, the famous New York Times journalist who had kind of whitewashed the Ukrainian famine, among other things, was enlisted in this campaign to kind of butter things up with the Americans, and at the very least to lift some of this embargo on new loans, and also just make it much more, I suppose, palatable and easier for Soviet agents to operate legally on U.S. territory. And diplomatic recognition was the first step, and that was a big part of it. Even before Roosevelt came to office, though, there was this long-form espionage mission headed by Stanislav Shumovsky, codenamed Blériot, who went to MIT and as early as 1931 had begun penetrating U.S. Research, but also weapons development, particularly in aviation. They were hard at work for a lot of the 1930s. It's just that after the Roosevelt administration legalized, that is, recognized the Soviet Union, a lot more of these Soviet agents could come in under diplomatic cover and operate legally. I mean, this is the problem the British had already faced, the Chinese had faced. Even in Mexico, there had been issues involving Soviet espionage. And people had tried to warn Roosevelt about this, that this was, at the very least, he should demand something up front in exchange for recognition, which offered all kinds of things to the Soviets. But in the end, Roosevelt was kind of, I suppose, just blinded by this kind of vision that maybe he could open up the Soviet market for U.S. exports. You know, we didn't really understand this. The Soviets had an insatiable appetite for U.S. technology. The real problem was they didn't have money to pay for it. And they preferred to steal it if they could.
The book is Stalin's War, A New History of World War II. Sean McMeekin is the author. When we come back, Stalin courting Hitler, 1939. This is CBSi on the World. I'm John Batchelor.